It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is back tomorrow. Coming up, this past weekend, Congress passed an omnibus spending bill, meaning it packaged a bunch of smaller bills into one vote. We'll unpack what's inside. First, President Obama announced a historic deal with Cuba today, paving the way for a resumption of diplomatic relations and the reopening of an American embassy in Havana. Here's a little bit of what the president had to say.
In the most significant changes in our policy in more than 50 years, we will end an outdated approach that for decades has failed to advance our interests, and instead, we will begin to normalize relations between our two countries. Through these changes, we intend to create more opportunities for the American and Cuban people and begin a new chapter among the nations of the Americas.
So what does the new chapter mean for both countries, and how close or far away are we from lifting an embargo that's divided the two countries for more than half a century? Here with us now is Jennifer McCoy. She's the director of the Americas Program at the Carter Center and professor of political science at Georgia State University. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, can you fill us in on what the president said about America's changing stance towards Cuba today?
Yes, this is really big news and welcome news to change a policy that really has not been effective for 50 years, that the U.S. has tried to isolate Cuba, but for about the last 40 years has been alone in its embargo, which means that a unilateral embargo, while others are trading with the country, is simply not effective. And obviously, it has not accomplished the change that U.S. law has put in place for 20 years to change the political regime in Cuba. So a major shift toward engagement is a big shift in policy that I think will be more productive, because it gives both American citizens and Cuban citizens more opportunity to travel, to exchange, to debate ideas, and it helps to empower Cubans themselves to make the changes that they want to make in their own country.
Why did the president make this announcement today? Why now?
Well, the obstacle to a major obstacle to improving relations with Cuba had been the imprisonment of an American contractor, Alan Gross. He had been imprisoned in Cuba for bringing in satellite equipment that is illegal in Cuba, and had been there for 5 years. His health was deteriorating, and I think both sides really wanted to resolve that issue and not to let it go too far. In addition, the Cubans had been demanding for many years the release of three, originally five, Cuban agents who had been imprisoned in U.S. prison for 16 years for spying within the U.S. They had been here spying actually on Cuban Americans who they felt were threatening Cuba. So in the end, the deal was to release Alan Gross, the American contractor, on humanitarian grounds, and to make an exchange of intelligence agents between Cuba and the United States, so that the three Cuban spies were released back to Cuba, and an American intelligence agent who'd apparently been imprisoned and most people didn't know about for 20 years in Cuba was returned to the United States. So that satisfied some needs on both sides and opened the way to move toward a more normal diplomatic relation, where both countries now can talk about concrete issues that are of interest to both sides, like immigration, like containing any potential contaminants from oil drilling, oil spills, cooperation on counterterrorism and counter-narcotics, so climate change, so a host of things.
What do we know about the role of the Castro regime in all of this and how that relationship has evolved over the years?
Well, when Raul Castro took over, when his brother Fidel fell ill in 2008, Raul Castro took over and so has been president for some time. He did begin some changes, primarily economic opening, so that Cubans now, some half million Cubans, have the ability to own their own businesses. As well, he lifted travel restrictions on Cubans. So Cubans can now, including dissidents and those who are opposed to his regime and speak out against him, now have much freer ability to travel outside the country. He also did one important political change in that he put term limits on his own presidency, which should end by 2018, and on all officials. Now, there are no free elections in Cuba. There's no competitive election or choice. But the fact of putting term limits on means that there's a transition, a generational transition, so that those who, like Fidel and Raul in their 80s, who led the revolution in 1959 and who had been leading the country, will be passing it on to a new generation. And he's incorporated new generations in the governing structure in the Council of State. So there is some important movement there, though, of course, we're still not talking about an open democracy.
Now, this announcement, it doesn't mean that everything has been resolved between the two countries, including trade. What are some of the sticking points that are still there?
Well, the U.S. still does have an embargo on Cuba, and that is the president does not have the authority to lift that embargo on his own. That authority moved from the presidency when it was first enacted in 1961 to the Congress in 1996 under the Helms-Burton Law signed by Bill Clinton, which gives the Congress the authority and the control over the trade embargo. So it will take congressional action to completely lift that embargo. What President Obama announced today are the things that he can do with presidential authority, which is relaxing travel restrictions on American citizens. Cuba is the only country that the U.S. itself restricts American citizens from traveling to. And so he's going to relax that. He's going to relax the amount of remittances that Cuban Americans can send to Cuba. He's going to relax some sort of loopholes in the embargo that allow some trade. And, you know, really public opinion and the private sector have been asking for these changes for quite some time. So I think they'll be welcomed by the majority of the American public.
So, as you said, Congress needs to take action as far as lifting the embargo goes, but some prominent lawmakers are already speaking out against doing that, some saying that we actually need to be strengthening the embargo instead. Do you have a sense of how sticky this point could become for Congress?
I think it will definitely be sticky. It's not going to be easy. These are the same voices that have pushed for 50 years to have a policy of isolation. The momentum is toward change. Public opinion, even within Cuban Americans in Florida, now favors lifting the embargo. Within the hemisphere, within the world, we are the only country with an embargo. And this has been a sticking point in better relations between the United States and the rest of this hemisphere. So I think that movement will definitely help. But the momentum is toward change. And I think the Congress will eventually come along, but it's not going to be immediate.
Well, going forward, you know, when it comes to talks over diplomatic relations between two countries who have this kind of history behind them, look at the Cuban Missile Crisis, for instance, it's been 50 years. How do you begin?
Well, you begin as we've already begun, first with citizen-to-citizen exchanges and travel. Student exchanges, academic exchanges, scientific, medical exchanges, but also with concrete, you know, talks between the governments on concrete issues. These have already been going on at low levels. We do have interest sections, which is something lower than an embassy in each country. So there are diplomats in representing each country in the other. And we've had low-level talks having to deal with concrete things like immigration and how many Cubans will be allowed visas to come into the United States. How many will the United States accept, for example, and trying to resolve issues of Cubans risking their lives coming over on rafts and small boats. Other issues, as I said, there's been a great interest as Cuba has been exploring to drill oil in the ocean, a great interest in making sure that they have the capacity, if that were to result in anything, to also contain any environmental impact of that and the capacity to respond to oil spills and that kind of thing. So there are very concrete issues to deal with. And then, of course, the issues of human rights and democracy should be kept on the horizon, on the agenda, and certainly should not be ignored. But empowering Cubans, for example, with greater communication capacity, which President Obama also announced today, facilitating the internet, facilitating fiber optic cables, for example, to the island, or telephone connections. These have been blocked by the United States, and so that hurts Cubans from being able to communicate with the outside world. So this will be a big step forward as well.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with Jennifer McCoy. She's the director of the Americas Program at the Carter Center and professor of political science at Georgia State University. President Obama announced today that the United States is going to begin normalizing economic and diplomatic relations with Cuba. The Cuban embargo was enacted through executive order by President Kennedy, and now President Obama plans to undo it through similar action. And what does Congress have to say? Well, it's our weekly look at Congress right now with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. Paul joins us every week at this time. Paul, good to have you back.
Hey, Veronica. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. Well, U.S.-Cuban relations have been regulated through both presidential executive action and bills passed by Congress for over half a century. How much can the president move to normalize U.S.-Cuba relations on his own?
Well, you know, he can do a lot with, again, expanding some of the categories of people who can travel, with expanding some of the business opportunities that can be opened there. You know, some of the economic relationship, he has some flexibility in. He can't raise the embargo by himself. He can start negotiations, but he can't appoint an ambassador by himself. That gets confirmed still by the Senate. He can't probably build an embassy by himself either. There's no money in the budget for that. I do think it is not coincidental that Obama announced this the day after the Senate completed its work on the continuing resolution and he signed it, because obviously the place where Congress would look to monkey in something like this is in a funding bill, where people could say, well, I'll remove the funding for whatever provisions of Cuba diplomacy that the administration is trying to pursue. So if nothing else, the Obama administration has bought themselves a year till September, when the government funding runs out again, before Congress really has a an immediate opportunity to engage in the funding question to try and block this this diplomatic action.
Well, this news just broke this morning when President Obama made his remarks. You mentioned areas like the embassy, the embargo, an ambassador. How is the move going over so far with Congress as to, you know, a litmus test as to what sort of appetite for these things there might be?
Well, you know, a bit of a mixed bag, as you would imagine. There are a lot of Cuba hardliners still in the U.S. Congress, many of them in the Republican Party, but not all of them, and some of them are Democrats as well. It's interesting because it's not a partisan issue. I mean, some of the angry statements that came out today included, you know, Bob Menendez, a Democrat from New Jersey of Cuban descent, who was you know, still believes that the United States should not be dealing with this government that you know, is undemocratic at best. But then there's also, you know, on the airplane to go get Alan Gross was Jeff Flake, a Republican from Arizona. So, you know, it's a very mixed bag. It doesn't necessarily split down party lines. And I honestly think that the while the intensity of the anti-Cuban faction will be stronger, Marco Rubio from Florida was on television today saying he would basically lie on the tracks, do anything he could to stop this. I think that the general trend towards liberalization has been stronger in the Congress for the past decade or so. Would not surprise me to see, not necessarily that they want to vote on it, but they want to let it happen without getting involved.
Were there rumblings that this was coming down the pike, or was this a surprise to some people?
Surprised me. None of us had a plan. Early this morning, we got a heads up from one of our good sources to watch out for something Cuba-related. But that was the first we'd heard of it.
Well, moving on to the spending bill. Now, this past weekend, Congress came to an agreement on a $1.1 trillion spending bill. So let's talk about some of the vocabulary involved here, cromnibus and omnibus. Tell us what exactly those are. What does that mean?
Cromnibus, which we'll hopefully never say again. Congress has basically, over the past, you know, several years, once upon a time, used to pass appropriations bills for each agency. There's 12 of them, actually 13 really, that Congress passes governing the all of the spending for the federal government. But they haven't been able to actually do that, pass individual bills, for years. So what they usually do is they run over their deadline and they pass what's called a continuing resolution, lasts for a couple of months, they call it a CR, while they hash out what they call an omnibus bill, which basically just wraps all of those other bills into one giant piece of legislation and passes sometime before Christmas. Well, this year they did a little bit of both. This thing is a hybrid. It is both a CR and an omnibus. It's an omnibus because it covers everything. It's a CR because there is one chunk of it, the Homeland Security Department, that is only partially funded for, it's only funded till February. It has a continuing resolution till February, no full year bill, because Republicans would like, once they take control of the Senate, to get another look at the funding for the Homeland Security Department and figure out if there's another way for them to block the president's executive action on immigration. They couldn't figure out a way to do it this time. They would like another shot at it in February when they have a majority.
Now, the thing about a bill like this with lots of little things packed inside it, or lots of big things, you're kind of like a clown car bill, is that there are these things that are tucked away that are sort of being discovered as we go along and written about and talked about. And one of these is a change in campaign donation limits. Can you tell us about what's going on there as far as campaign finance?
Basically, earlier this year, Congress passed a bill that essentially eliminated federal financing for conventions, for the party conventions. And they moved that money to something like, you know, pediatric health research, because who could oppose that? So in this bill, they raised the amount of money that an individual can donate to the political parties for the purposes of funding their conventions, in theory. So you go from a guy or a woman for that matter, who used to be able to write a check for $100,000 that was the max they were allowed to spend in campaigns throughout the year. Now that number goes closer to $1 million that they're allowed to contribute throughout the year to all contributions. It is simply a way to basically raise a bunch more money. The concern is that it is also a way to reward big donors with new opportunities to help out the party leaders.
And to look at another aspect of this, this is a financial reform that's being rolled back, the 2010 Dodd-Frank financial reform package.
Yes, please don't get me into the details of Dodd-Frank. there's a reason why there was an economic crash, because none of us understood what derivatives are. I still don't. But what this provision does is roll back limits on government financing. The government insures banks. There were some of these derivatives that were considered too risky to insure. That's what Dodd-Frank did. It said, basically, you guys want to take your risks on these derivatives, knock yourself out, but the government's not going to back you on them. This provision puts the government backing back into that. So now, once again, they're gambling with taxpayers' money. The issue with both these provisions is they just sort of emerged in the bill at the last minute. Nobody had seen them. Nobody knew where they were coming from. Nobody knew why they were there. So they really sprung on everybody, including many members of the Congress.
Well, how do things like that wind up in a bill at the last minute without, you know, a lot of debate?
Because it's 3 o'clock in the morning. It's a 1,600-page bill. Nobody's paying attention. Everyone wants to go home for Christmas. You know, this is the last. We call these things Christmas trees because they are the last bill of the year, and everybody wants to hang their bauble on them, and someone slips it in. I mean, apparently there was one smart campaign finance lawyer who got the provision in for the convention funding. There were some banking attorneys and lobbyists who got the provision in on Dodd-Frank. The Republicans have been very suspicious of Dodd-Frank all along. They think it's an overreach of federal government regulation. You know, things fall in there. There was a bunch of marijuana legislation in there. Someone pulled the sage grouse out of the Endangered Species Act. You know, it's like your grandmother's attic. You know, there's all kinds of stuff in there, and you won't find out for months what all the details are.
Well, I want to touch on one more thing before we let you go. The United States has a new Surgeon General. We haven't had one for over a year, but the Senate, they confirmed Dr. Vivek Murthy on Monday. Now, he passed despite opposition from Republicans. What's been holding up his confirmation?
Well, you know, the funny thing about this is that the only reason they were able to pass some of these nominations is because some Republicans, particularly Senator Ted Cruz, objected to moving forward with the cromnibus. So there was just a bunch of dead time on the Senate schedule. So Harry Reid was like, okay, fine, we'll just pass a bunch of nominations. So the Republicans were actually really mad at Ted Cruz for opening the door for the pastor of these nominations. Vivek Murthy, the issue is he's a young guy, doesn't have a great deal of experience, but the real issue is the NRA had opposed him because he has said in the past basically that guns are a public health issue. He also had been very actively campaigning for Obama in 2008. He had created an organization called Doctors for Obama. So Republicans just didn't like him for a bunch of reasons. And, you know, it was very his nomination's been hanging out there for more than a year, and they haven't been able to act on it. It just happened to be an interesting window of opportunity, and the Democrats took it.
And real quickly, Paul, before we let you go, does the Surgeon General office, do you think, still have clout?
Have you heard of the last Surgeon General?
Not so much.
See? There's stuff they do, and they can be very interesting. And then in past years, in past eras, they have been very influential. But now, when they get influential, is when they get fired because they said something the president wasn't ready to say.
Well, Paul, thanks a lot for joining us, and we'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon, Veronica. Bye-bye.
We've been speaking with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us every week to give us the lowdown on what Congress is and isn't doing. He'll join us on Friday next week to talk about the year in Washington and the legacy of the country's least productive Congress since 1973. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is back tomorrow. This month, about 200 people in Wisconsin were hospitalized with the flu. And yesterday, there were reportedly 150 students absent from the Milwaukee suburb of Glendale this week with flu-like symptoms. And there are doubts about just how effective this year's flu vaccine may be compared with the strain of the flu that's going around. We'll find out if the flu shot helps and what to do if you come down with the flu. John Tempty joins us now. He's a physician at UW Health who specializes in family medicine. He's also the chair of the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. John, welcome to Central Time.
Well, good afternoon, Veronica. How are you doing?
Doing well, thanks.
Good.
Based on what you and other UW Health doctors have seen, how bad is the flu season so far this year?
Well, I think we are on the very beginning of a pretty bad outbreak. We're seeing more and more cases coming into clinics, and as you mentioned in your lead-in, we're seeing more and more absenteeism from school. And even to the extent I can say that I had one of my children home for a couple of days early this week.
What determines how bad a flu season is going to be?
That's a wonderful question, and it depends on a number of things. First, it depends on the strain of virus that's in circulation. And the virus that we're seeing most commonly this year is the type that tends to be the nastiest in terms of causing illness, complications of other medical problems, and even deaths. And so the particular virus is called influenza A H3. And this is one that we look for. The other strains, there's an influenza A H1 and influenza B. And those viruses tend to be a little less aggressive than this particular one. The other factor that's really important is how many people are vaccinated and how effective the vaccine is in a particular season.
Okay, so we've got a particularly nasty flu strain going around the season. So then the hope is that people go get vaccinated and they don't get the flu. But I've heard this year that the vaccine didn't quite hit the mark. What do we know about how effective the vaccine is?
Well, we always know much better about how effective the vaccine is after the fact. The way we determine that is looking as to how good it is about preventing influenza. That being said, when we have a mismatch between the vaccine and the circulating viruses, the vaccine tends to be less effective. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not effective. It does provide partial protection, but it's not as good as you have when you have a perfect match. And so if I go back to last year, if we look across the United States, and in particular, I always concentrate on the upper Midwest, but we had a match of about 98% between the circulating viruses and our vaccine. And this year, we're down in the high 60s or low 70s if we account for the partial match.
Okay, so in terms of coverage, let's say, you know, someone gets exposed to the flu, as we, you know, probably will sometime this winter. What do we know about how protected we'll be?
Well, first off, it depends what strain you're encountering. But what I can tell you is that from previous studies, we know even when there's a mismatch but some activity, we may become ill, but we probably won't get as sick as would be the case without that vaccine.
So people should still get the flu shot this year if they haven't. And if they have, you're saying they're going to have some coverage.
That's correct. And the thing to keep in mind is we have not reached the peak of influenza by any means yet. We're probably 2 or 3 weeks out yet. And once we hit the peak, it means that still 50% of the people who are going to come down with flu are yet to come down with it. And with that in mind, we still have time to offer some protection for people by getting the influenza vaccine at this point in time if they haven't been already vaccinated.
How long does it take after you get the shot or the mist before you start to have some protection?
Typically, 14 days after immunization, you're up to full protection.
Now, we've heard about 200 people being hospitalized statewide. This was back in December, let's see, December 10th, I think it was. So it's possible those numbers have climbed. People hospitalized with the flu. What kinds of things necessitate going to the hospital when you have the flu? Because most of us think, you know, it's like a really bad cold. You probably won't end up in the hospital. What do we need to look out for?
Well, with the last report from my colleague over at the Department of Health Services, we're up to 276 patients as of last Friday. But the things that will bring people into the hospital typically are high fevers and difficulty breathing. Influenza can cause a direct viral pneumonia in and of itself. But in particular, we see complications of pre-existing medical conditions. So our patients who have underlying lung disease, our patients with underlying heart disease, are particularly prone to complications, as are people with immune problems and people with neurological conditions. The other group I really have to point out is pregnant women, because influenza and pregnancy just does not mix very well.
How come?
Well, the whole process of pregnancy alters the immune system, and pregnant women are much more prone to very aggressive influenza illness compared to their colleagues. And we know that with infection, there are significant adverse outcomes. For example, there was a great study done in the United Kingdom right after the pandemic went through. This was 2009 and 2010. And there was, for women who were pregnant and infected with flu versus those that were not, there was about a five-fold increase in stillbirth, in preterm birth, and in perinatal mortality or death of that newborn in the immediate period after being born. So that those are huge numbers, and those are things that we think we can reduce through good vaccination policy.
Well, so those are some scary things you just said there, especially about pregnant women and flu. So let's say you are pregnant, you're listening, you've taken your advice, you've gone and gotten your flu shot. What can you do to protect yourself from not picking it up in the first place?
Well, you hit something very important here. A lot of women who are pregnant also have young children at home. And young children are wonderful about picking up influenza viruses at school or daycare and bringing it back home. So the first important thing is making sure you're immunized if you're pregnant. We recommend that across the board for all pregnant women. Second of all, because we know that we have less than a perfect match this year, that if somebody does come down with flu-like symptoms, and for simplicity, we normally indicate a flu-like symptom is a fever and a cough or a sore throat. But if those are the cases, it is very reasonable to contact your physician or your other healthcare provider, at least talk to them over the phone to see what they would suggest. If people are significantly ill, starting an antiviral medication very early on in the illness can really speed up the recovery. It can reduce the illness, and it may reduce the complications.
Should everybody do that?
Well, if we follow the guidelines from Centers for Disease Control and the real experts out there in influenza, we don't think everybody needs treatment. It really has to be guided by who the person is, how sick they are, and what other medical problems they might have. And so, for example, the American College of Gynecologists and Obstetricians has a good guideline for management of patients who have flu-like symptoms and are contacting them. Typically, we would suggest that treatment would be warranted for most women who are pregnant and who have influenza.
And as far as getting that antiviral treatment or something like Tamiflu, is it ever too late to start taking it?
Well, unfortunately, there are some pretty set timelines with this this drug. When it is started extremely early in the case of influenza, it can be very effective. In the course of my medical career, I've had the opportunity to do this a number of times. I watch for influenza. I know when it's out there. I recognize it. And I have the technology in my clinic to test for it very rapidly. But when I do this very early on, we have wonderful effects. However, if you get past 48 hours, the benefit of that drug really drops off where it's very hard to determine any benefit. The one exception, though, is for patients who are hospitalized. And even if they've been ill for more than 48 hours, recommendations are to at least give the medication a try. It's inexpensive. It's very non-toxic. It doesn't cause a whole lot of side effects, and it may give some benefit.
We're talking about this year's flu season with John Tempty. He's a physician at UW Health who specializes in family medicine. He's also the chair of the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. We're talking about flu season here in Wisconsin, taking a look at this year's flu vaccine and how well it's working. And we're also trying to get a handle on what to do when the flu strikes. And we'd like to hear from you. Have you gotten hit with this year's flu? How is it affecting your life or your holiday season? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post at the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing with John Tempty, a physician at UW Health who specializes in public health. And we'll go to our first call. Now, Danny is joining us in Toma. Hi, Danny.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I was curious. I've never had the flu. I'm 60 years old, and I've never been vaccinated for the flu either. Is it possible that I'm immune to it?
Well, I'm not sure if you're immune to it or not, but everyone handles infections differently. And there are a handful of people who get along just fine without ever being immunized. I'm not sure if they're more effective at avoiding infection or if there's something else going on. We do know, however, that individuals who are carrying antibodies from flu infections dating back decades sometimes are protected. For example, during the 2009-2010 pandemic of H1N1 that we all heard about, people who were age 55 and older had very, very little illness, and it's because they may have had a mild case of flu back in their childhood days when this virus was circulating previously.
Well, thanks a lot for your call, Danny. Appreciate that. Lucky guy, never really gotten the flu, which makes me wonder if some of us have had the flu, but we don't really know that we have the flu. So as far as this season's flu strains, what are the symptoms to look out for? How do we know that we're not just getting another cold?
Well, it's very interesting. First of all, when I'm talking to patients, there are two questions I always ask. One is, when did this illness start? And if they are kind of hem and haw and say, oh, it 2 or 3 or 4 days ago, it's likely not influenza. If they tell me it was 2:30 on Sunday afternoon, that's a pretty good indication. Flu influenza tends to hit very hard when it starts. There is a release of a lot of inflammatory compounds in your body that just make you feel awful. That being said, the other question I often ask is, who were you around 2 or 3 days before your illness started? And were you around anybody with similar symptoms? And when they say, I was around somebody with symptoms like I have, that's a pretty good indication as well, because the incubation period is anywhere from about 1 to 3 days. What we're seeing this year, a lot of cough, sore throat, and fever. And along with that, there certainly can be muscle aches, chest feeling dragged out. The term we use is malaise, and certainly nasal congestion and discharge. So a lot of symptoms, but the things that we typically go off of is that fever, and typically fever is over 100 degrees, and a cough and or sore throat.
Feeling pretty miserable.
Exactly.
Okay, well, thanks to Danny. We move on to Paige in Walworth. Hi, Paige.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering, I know there's a lot of strains out there, and it's guesswork on what to include in the shot. And I was wondering, if it wasn't one of those strains, is it possible that one of the strains that was in the shot is helpful to other strains? I mean, by getting a flu shot, would it be helpful to one of the strains that isn't in the flu shot?
That's a great question. And I'll start out by saying that in about March every year, the World Health Organization and CDC get together and try and determine which viruses should go into the vaccine. So we're making decisions back in the early spring for what's going to be happening in October, November, and December the following year. So a lot can happen between then and now. But we look at what's going in circulation at the end of the flu season. We also look at what's happening in the southern hemisphere during the start of their flu season, which typically is going to be in May and June, and make decisions. But and I can also say that most of the time, the people who make decisions get it right. This year, we've seen this different virus, a drifted or one that has a little bit different genetics than what was in the vaccine. But immunization with the current vaccine will give some partial protection for this other strain of virus. So you're absolutely correct there. It's not as good as a perfect match, but it will likely reduce symptoms, hopefully keep people from not being as sick as they may have been in the past.
Well, thanks a lot for that call, Paige. And we've got a comment here from Barb on Facebook who says, had it last week, brutal, but now I'm immune and good to go. Is that right, once you've had it, say, this year, that you're immune for the rest of the season or maybe forever?
Well, yes and no. You're immune for the strain that you became ill with. However, right now we have in circulation and co-circulation, we have two varieties of A viruses and two varieties of Bs. And typically in Wisconsin, we'll tend to see the influenza A viruses hit early, and often influenza B is much later in the season, typically seeing them in February, and sometimes even as late as May. And because right now I could make a pretty good guess that Barb was sick with influenza AH3, that's not going to offer a whole lot of protection 2 months from now if we're seeing a resurgence of influenza B.
Oh, boy. So no get-out-of-jail-free cards with the flu, huh?
Unfortunately not. It's a very interesting virus, and unfortunately, it's one that carries a lot of significant problems. You know, unfortunately, so far this season, we have had 7 deaths reported in children across the country, and that's always such a tragedy.
Well, I want to ask you about that. We've seen a lot of absences in Wisconsin schools. I've just been hearing anecdotally this morning that some local schools had 2 kids show up in the classroom that day. If your child goes to one of these schools where the flu is sweeping through, should you keep them home preventatively?
Well, that's a good question. Usually by the time you have a lot of absenteeism, it's pretty well circulated through everybody. And when I say we, my research team and I are monitoring absenteeism in the Oregon School District, and we get a daily feed of information. And as of Monday and Tuesday this week, so just the last 2 days, influenza-like illnesses just exploded in that school district. And I think that's true across the state. Just watching the news this morning from Milwaukee and some communities further north. But that being said, recommendations out there, well, first of all, understanding how flu is transmitted is very important. So this is a disease or an infection that's spread by droplets. It's a cough or it's a sneeze. And to have that transmitted, you have to be within 3 or 4 feet of somebody who is actively coughing and sneezing. If there was somebody in a room and coughed and sneezed, you know, a minute ago and you walk in, you're not at risk. But if you are the sad recipient of the droplets from somebody's cough or sneeze, it's very, very contagious like that. And so things like good hand washing, people who are ill really doing a good job of covering a cough and sneeze, or even to the extent of wearing a face mask when you're in and around sick people can make a big difference.
And we have to leave it there. Dr. Temte, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure, and good luck.
Dr. John Temte is a physician at UW Health who specializes in family medicine. He's also the chair of the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. And now we've got a real-life example about how to get along across the political divide that's making some news today. Last night, a couple of political pundits from opposite sides of the spectrum were getting into it on C-SPAN, and we know how that can go, when the two brothers started taking live calls on the air. The one person, probably the one person in the world who could help, stepped up. And here's what happened.
No, go to Joy in Raleigh, North Carolina. Good
morning. Hey, somebody from down south.
Well, you're right. I'm from down south.
Oh, God's mom.
And I'm your mother. And I disagree that all families are like ours. I don't know many families that are fighting at Thanksgiving. And I'm hoping you'll have some of this out of your system when you come here for Christmas. And I love you both.
And there you have it. All our political troubles can be solved by our moms. Probably most of us knew that already.